Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast. My name is Umair. I am the Knowledge to Action Lead with Gen Squeeze. With me are my colleagues Andrea Long, Senior Director of Research and Knowledge Mobilization, and Paul Kershaw, Gen Squeeze founder and UBC policy professor. Today's podcast discussion will be about some of the ways in which we work to advise various levels and institutions in government. If you go to the Gen Squeeze website and look under the What We Do tab, you'll see that, among a few other things, it says that we advise governments. So we thought we'd talk about some of that work, what it involves, including why we think the work is important, and some of the mechanics that go into it. And actually, the reason we're having the discussion now is because earlier this month, on December 6th, Paul was invited to speak to the Senate of Canada's Standing Committee on National Finance. So we figured we'd use that as a jumping off point to talk about our work in advising governments more generally. Okay, how does all that sound?
Sounds good to me. I think it means that the hard truth is that, and it's a hard truth, especially for academics like me, that evidence is rarely enough to change public policy or improve our systems unless we think about how we're going to hustle and mobilize that evidence in the world of politics. Because politics responds to those who organize and show up. Rarely do they respond just to evidence.
Speaking of being organized and showing up, you know, I realized while I was watching the video of your appearance.
Did we put you to sleep?
No. I could have just walked over and attended because I live like 15 minutes away from the Senate. But I never think of myself as like, oh, I can just pop on over to Parliament. So anyway.
One of the many ways in which you're fortunate living in our country's beautiful capital city. So many things. You can go sit in the Supreme Court. You can go, you know, hang out and just watch a good round of question period.
No. Part of the reason why because I know you're making this joke is like, as if like no one would want to do this, but.
No, I'm serious. It actually is important and fun. I'd love to go sit in the Supreme Court more often.
Yeah, but I mean, the question period, I think I would probably avoid. That's more for like TV.
That one, sure. Yeah.
The committee hearing that you attended along with the other guests, like I thought it was actually really interesting to listen to. And I feel like if I'd gone in person, it would have been all the more engaging.
Well, we can jump in because there's something different about actually going before the Senate these days, now that the Senate is kind of less partisan than it used to be. And so there were less, I experienced it to have fewer kind of gotcha politics intentions and more about, okay, there's these public policy issues that are being featured in the fall economic statement in the 2022 budget, and let's engage a range of thoughtful people on that to hear their perspectives. So what a novel and good idea in the world of politics.
That's true. It is heartening to know, though, I think your observation, Paul, about like the Senate maybe being a less partisan political context is kind of important and interesting to reflect on more, because I know you've also appeared at other committees in the past, House of Commons committees, including finance and other places. And having seen some of those sessions, I doubt those are definitely in part about, you know, party representatives trying to push their agenda and critique the agendas of other parties. So it's an interesting opportunity to have folks in the Senate perhaps come together more around trying to, you know, think through solutions to policy issues that we face without the political constraints of party affiliation.
So what was this committee meeting about, Paul, and why were you invited?
So the Senate, just like the House of Commons, has regular meetings on various policy issues that come before them in terms of legislation. And this particular legislation that they were looking at were included parts of the fall economic statement and parts of the 2022 budget. And as people who follow Gen Squeeze will know, one of the things that we think is especially important to do is to shape government budgets, because those are the overarching documents that determine really all else that governments do when it comes to investing, when it comes to raising revenue, when it comes to setting their priorities. And so in this particular case, we didn't apply at Gen Squeeze to be heard from at the Senate. They invited us because of our public profile and material they'd seen from us in the media in a range of ways, and they wanted us to hear our thoughts on the fall economic statement and budget 2022. And also because Andrea did pen a really thoughtful analysis of the fall economic statement that was out there in our social channels. And one of the senators was specifically referring to that analysis in her questions to me. So that's how it came about. And, you know, when Jen Squeeze thinks about how do we mobilize evidence in the world of politics, you know, sometimes we're playing an outside game. And by outside game, I mean, like, we're trying to engage the broader public and shape public opinion and frame beliefs and earn media attention, because that helps to create a sort of outside political cover for politicians to courageously respond to the data that's, you know, driving our analysis of solutions from the lab at UBC. But other times, Jen Squeeze aims to go directly into the halls of power. Sometimes, like, we're proactive in wanting to do that, and we put out our budget recommendations or budget analyses and then invite ministers and their deputies and their other staff to meet with us to discuss. And other times, we take up invitations for us to go and present that come out organically from the world of politics in response to our broader activities. So the Senate committee was an example of that. It was a wide-ranging two-hour session, as you said, Mary, you didn't make it to the end, where I was a part of a panel also with the CEO of the Canadian Real Estate Association. I think there's a CEO of the Canadians for Tax Fairness, and then representatives of Canada's building trade unions. Those four groups didn't get to put ourselves together as a panel. The Senate committee brought us together as a panel and asked a range of questions. And I spoke from, you know, themes related to pricing pollution to, you know, making sure $10 a day childcare is the maximum fee, not the average. And we spent a lot of time talking about housing. Well, more generally, one senator, Senator Bovee, definitely is an ally for Jen Squeeze in the Senate in a way I didn't quite understand and now really want to take my hat off and it's a signal. Way to go, Senator Bovee. Really appreciate you. And she was creating opportunities for us to more generally talk about the dysfunctional intergenerational system that we have in Canada. And that's valuable in the world of politics because often we get asked to talk about the symptoms of problems, housing, climate change, family unaffordability. Less often do we get invited to talk about the underlying disease of generational unfairness. And Senator Bovee really helped us out on this particular day.
So, Andrew, since the background to the appearance in the hearing was the statement that you wrote on our behalf about the fall economic statement. So why did we do an analysis of the fall economic statement to begin with?
Yeah, well, like budgets, which are the centerpiece of much of our work that Paul's already focused on, the fall economic statements are sort of another opportunity for us to, you know, take a look at what governments are forecasting as their priorities and areas of focus over the coming months, and to have a chance to, you know, share that with our network and others who are interested in knowing more about how those issues intersect with generational fairness and what they mean for whether we're advancing or retreating from generational fairness as a priority. So, although the fall economic statements, you know, it's not just the federal government does those, provinces do them as well. And we've actually written commentary on what's been said in Ontario and what's been said in Alberta of late as well. They're not as certainly well-known as the budgets. They're not the big marquee moment that tends to drive the kind of media and public engagement you get around budgets, but they are a good early signal. And, you know, it's important, I think, for groups like Generation Squeeze that are really trying to influence the broad policy landscape, influence the systems and institutions that structure that landscape, that we, you know, flag to people, there are opportunities throughout the year to weigh into that process and to, you know, articulate what our concerns and issues are and what the solutions to them are as well. So the fall economic statement analysis is just another place to be able to make those kinds of views known. And you know, I think what Paul's invitation to the Senate committee shows that that's really valuable because it's an opportunity that those analyses get in front of people. And it's an opportunity for us to peer in places like the Senate committee and discuss some of our issues further.
Yeah, I think Andrea's underselling herself a little bit there, because prior to Andrea joining the Jen Squeeze team, we were limited in our person power and tended to focus only on the budget moment. So, and there's good reason for that and reasons that we've described in the past. Those are the primary documents. But there's kind of three moments in the legislature that are these sort of agenda-setting moments. And there's the throne speech that will come at the opening of a new session of the legislature, which will typically come before a budget. And that's often what I would describe poetry, you know, people, lofty statements, lovely language, but it's giving signals about the agenda ahead. And then the budget really gives you the prose and the nitty-gritty and just to so much detail you can feel overwhelmed. Indeed, one of our critiques is that actually many budgets hide some of the biggest trends that are unfolding in the blueprints in the back tables and don't give people those details because there's just so many pages and they get distracted. distracted by what's often smaller. And then Andrea is coming in and rightly pointing out about the fall economic statement. That comes often, you know, 5, 6, 7 months later and lets us know, were they on track with what they were projecting in the budget or how have things changed? So these are moments when the legislature is being very good and transparent and democratic, letting Canadians know about how our tax dollars and tax investments are being collected and spent, and giving us chances to comment on the priorities as established by governments, and then signaling the windows of opportunity when we can try and proactively reach out to our members of parliament, provincially and federally, to shape what goes in the next document that they're going to talk about, typically the budget. And so, you know, we were invited just organically by the Senate in this case to come up here. But that invitation comes about in no small part because when we write fall economic statement analyses or budget analyses or put out new reports, we're typically working with our colleagues at Impact Public Affairs, who then distribute our releases to every MP at the federal level, every MPP at the Ontario government level, every MLA in the BC level, and if it's relevant to other jurisdictions, we'll be sending it there too. And that's just one of the ways in which we're not only broadcasting on our social channels like Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, but we're also working intentionally to bring our information directly to the decision makers.
Yeah, I wonder if we could talk a bit more about the importance of this work. Because, I mean, I've complained that we don't necessarily do a good job in talking about it on our website, even though it's a core part of what we do. And as we talked about, in fact, in the last podcast discussion, it's actually really a fundamental to the change-making process as far as we've been able to make change.
Definitely.
Yeah. So maybe, where does the impetus for this come from?
Well, you mean you're referring back to the hard truth that, you know, the academic in me says, okay, we work hard to produce good evidence. We put the evidence out there, whatever the heck that means. And we hope it gets discovered by people with the power to make the change called for by the evidence. And I think the reality that political science teaches us is that just putting the evidence out there is rarely going to get discovered by people with the power to make the change in our parliaments, because they're busy people with so many competing demands, and people are working the world of politics, bringing ideas, sometimes evidence-based, sometimes not, to decision makers to act on. That's why the kind of work that we do at Gen Squeeze plays this outside game, shaping public opinion to create political cover, but directly works inside in the halls of power as well. And it's all why Andrea has been working so hard to raise this theme of like rejuvenating democracy as one of the key value propositions at Gen Squeeze. So I'll hand it over to you, Andrea, to flesh that out for me.
Thanks. Yeah. So what you said is definitely like half the answer to Amir's question, or a portion of the answer to Amir's question. And I think another important piece about why this work is important to us is because, you know, Gen Squeeze is really grounded in the idea that we all have to opt in to political processes if we want to realize the sorts of changes that we need to make Canada work for all generations. Although we may be frustrated and disillusioned, and we may, you know, get tired of the tone of debate. We already mentioned question period being a bit of a sideshow these days. All those things may be the case, but we still can't, we can't opt out of the process because individual Canadians on their own can't change the sort of institutions and structures that we need to change in order to achieve greater generational fairness. So, you know, I think that's at the core of our idea of what it means to rejuvenate democracy, because rejuvenating democracy is saying to our elected officials, like, we need to expect more from you. We need to follow the process. We need to, you know, follow the recommendations of organizations like Gen Squeeze and push our elected officials to be able to implement those. But we also need to expect more of ourselves as well. We need to expect all of us to be engaged in the process, to, you know, get ourselves informed, to help inform others by, you know, talking to your friends and your family and your networks, because all of us create the politics and the political systems that we end up with. So we're a key part of changing them as well.
I'm wondering if we can concretize this a bit more. So how often are we doing this sort of thing?
Well, I can reflect on this past week. So we were invited into the Senate of Canada. We had multiple meetings with our Ontario MPPs from two different parties. We were liaising with the government of BC's new minister on housing, new finance minister, and for that matter, the premier's office. And we were reaching out also in Ottawa. We were liaising because the budget isn't that far away. And we were reaching out to people in finance and treasury, asking to have a chance to chat with them about making sure that the budget press release for budget 2023 federally highlights the fact that the fall economic statement just showed us that they anticipate old age security to grow in spending by $27 billion of extra annual investment. That's what we're projecting over the next few years. That's as much as we invest in employment insurance entirely in a year. That's as much as we invest in the Canada Child Benefit pretty much entirely in a year. That's how much we're expecting to grow old age security. And so we were just saying, please make sure that gets a bullet point. And so we've been doing some corresponding with, as I mentioned, finance and treasury. So that was last week. And that's, you know, some weeks we'll be more public-oriented focused. We do lots and lots of media. So lots of media work was infused in between that as well. But there will be many weeks where we can try and cut some time out of our busy schedules to intentionally be responding to requests from government and sometimes actually making requests to meet with them specifically.
And then, oh, sorry, Andrew, you were going to say?
I was just going to add one thing to that because I think it kind of goes back to your point, Umair, that, you know, this aspect of Jen Squeeze's work is maybe something we could improve our storytelling about. You know, I think one of the dimensions of this kind of work when you're, you know, engaging and advising governments is that some of it is public. Some of it, you know, we want to make public and we want to rally our network around helping us draw attention to those things. But there are other moments when the avenue for influence and trying to make change is a little more of the behind the curtain sort of element where, you know, you're having meetings with key officials, you're, you know, trying to bring, you know, partly the evidence forward. As Paul said, the evidence is never enough. So we're also bringing forward our, you know, key framing to try and make meaning of that evidence. We're bringing forward our key sort of metaphors to try and, you know, illustrate to people why this evidence is important and what, you know, sort of the parallels are. And, you know, that stuff we can sometimes make public, but sometimes there is just this behind the scenes push in terms of building relationships, cultivating trust, that's really critical to the kind of incremental change. And yes, incremental change can be very slow and tedious, but that is sometimes the way to ultimately lead towards the bigger picture kind of change that we're looking for.
Yeah, that's really well said, Andrea, because I think maybe as people are hearing us, they sort of have in mind this sort of this vision of lobbying. What does lobbying look like? And the way that Jen Squeeze can be effective is very different than the way that, say, like the pharmaceutical lobby or the fossil fuel lobby or the, you know, the developers lobby can, like, we don't have big wallets and big pockets or anything. Like, we can't offer any of that to politicians. We can be effective in the halls of power advising government when we can be useful. And we do have a lot of use to offer because of this unique university community collaboration that is Generation Squeeze. On the one hand, you know, based in one of our country's most prestigious universities, generating ideas in response to key relevant policy issues that matter to decision makers today. And then not just with the evidence, though, going, as Andrew mentioned, around like how do we frame it? How do we make this meaningful for people? And we pay a lot of attention to that in terms of which party are we meeting with? Like, well, how will it matter for conservatives? What values matter to them? How will it matter for someone who's a liberal, for an NDP, for a green? How do we know their values, interpret accordingly, and then offer them the evidence and some framing that will be useful for their constituencies? Because they have to play in the world of politics. And, you know, people listening will know that Jen Squeeze oftentimes is a target of a lot of angry emails, and we've been politicized for some of our taxation suggestions. But we talk about a vast range of things. Like Andrea's most recent reference to reframing issues made me think of, we were recently briefing folks in Health Canada, helping those decision makers, you know, negotiate the federal, provincial, territorial meetings that have been happening lately, and people are worried about the crisis in our healthcare system. And we're like, well, here's the data about how health spending has been changing federally and provincially. And let's remember, health isn't just about what happens in our hospitals. It's about how we invest in the conditions into which we're born, grow, live, work, and age. Housing is a health investment. Poverty reduction is a health investment. Childcare is a health investment. Medical care is an illness treating investment. And so we were, you know, we bring that framing into the meetings that we take. And I'm on a soapbox. So one last thought. you know, people will have heard me talk a lot about the $10 a day childcare win, that we take a lot of pride in it, Jen Squeeze. You know, that language making its way into the federal budget, and the idea that childcare shouldn't be another rent or mortgage-sized payment or not more than university tuition, that was partly about evidence, but it was just as much about the framing of the existing evidence. And so I think that's really a key part of the value add that Jen Squeeze, our think and change tank, brings into the halls of power, made more influential by our tens of thousands of allies.
So I'm wondering how over time, you know, this section of our work of advising governments, like, has this become more prominent than it was at the beginning? And then also, has the reception to our ideas that we bring to governments and to parties, has that changed at all? Or has it sort of always been similar, positive, negative, neutral?
Yes, I think reflecting on the history of Jen Squeeze, Andrew, I'll do that part first and then pass it over to you. I think that we've always had an advised government component. That actually is, you know, that's part of the professional responsibilities of an academic. And so that part has always been with us. How we are perceived, it ebbs and flows. It was worrisome to us at Jen Squeeze when our work on the price on housing inequity by putting a surtax on home value over $1 million got so politicized and so misrepresented in a lot of the media. And then it was being brought directly for finance ministers and housing ministers to comment on. And suddenly you're like, wow, we have such a range of issues we're trying to bring to people. But if they view this as too hot to touch, we won't get back into various departments at levels of government. So that, you know, that can have us a little bit worried. But as we just described, you know, what did last week look like? Now we do have regular meetings with a range of parties. I think we're perceived to be a really strong reputation of nonpartisanship. Our voters' guide works routinely show many different parties coming out of top on different issues. And I think that helps people, helps parties know that they can play with us in the world of politics without worrying about gotcha moments. But let's never be naive. And then I'll hand it over to Andrea because she knows how politicized it can get. Like, our work can get politicized and weaponized in the world of politics when it's convenient for parties to do so.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't speak obviously to the early days of Jen Squeeze, but I think in terms of your question about, you know, how things have evolved from the beginning, but I think there's one important observation about just our sort of place in the landscape of political commentary and political advocacy work, and that I think has importantly changed is, I think there is broader sort of appreciation and understanding of the need to think about generational issues around generational justice or injustice in our public policy. And I think Jen Squeeze has really played an important role carving out that space in Canada. And I think the fact that, you know, you don't have to, you know, we're not starting by just making the case for why this issue even matters or like, what is this all about every time means that, you know, the reaction to our work, I think, can kind of grow from a different place that we can, you know, I think have an opportunity to delve more deeply into the way in which there are different symptoms of that problem that we see across a range of public policies, as Paul mentioned, you know, housing and childcare and other things that folks who follow us will know we engage in all the time. So I think that that piece, that growth of the, you know, understanding of generational fairness is a sort of key way in which our work to advise governments has shifted a bit. I think the other piece, Paul, I wanted to mention, you kind of touched on the voter's guide. And I do think it's interesting to see, like, we've been doing voter's guides, well, I'm not actually sure, for a while now. And for those of you who are familiar with them, our voters' guides are nonpartisan analyses of party platforms during elections and the commitments they make on various issues that align with our solutions frameworks. And our solutions frameworks are these really, I think, excellent syntheses of evidence around the actions we need to take to achieve specific policy goals. So I think Jen Squeeze plays a really important and unique function of trying to integrate a lot of evidence into a single set of solutions rather than just sort of focusing in on a particular aspect of an issue.
And just to keep that, you mean solutions framework to solve housing unaffordability and family unaffordability and climate. So really big goals, and we synthesize many, many policy changes that need to be made to achieve those big goals.
Yes, thank you. And I think that those voters' guides, one thing that also has changed, I think, in terms of our perception of our advised government's work, is parties are now aware of the fact that that's a piece of work that we do, that we're going to take their platform documents and their detailed costings of their commitments, and we're going to assess them against the various criteria in our policy solutions frameworks. And we're going to score them accordingly, and we're going to make the results of those analyses public, and we're going to really get behind them and try to say to voters, you know, we want you to equip you. You can vote for whomever you want. We're not making a recommendation as to which party you support, but we want you to know, have this information about how parties stack up on their promises in terms of advancing the goal of generational fairness in a Canada that works for all generations. And I think the fact that parties now know that that's work that we're going to do, you know, we've seen that they actually, that influences what they say and do in terms of their platforms. So I think that's another sort of really critical piece of where, you know, our influence has grown over time. Again, that can be somewhat behind the scenes in terms of the type of influence that we're having, but we know it's happening. We see it happening. We have the conversations with party officials that tell us that it's happening. So it's a really concrete, I think, contribution that we're making to shifting the dialogue around generational fairness and public policy.
That's a really key observation because, you know, a group like ours, we're constantly wanting to be more powerful, more influential. And there are very few moments when we can actually be quite influential or where parties are anxious about whether our opinion matters. But because of the way that we've demonstrated that we can do these voters' guides on issues that go from healthcare to housing to family policy and childcare to climate change and then just budgets and deficits. And like, so we're covering a wide range of terrain, and we've been doing it enough that the media is now socialized that we're going to do it. And because we have the credibility and credentials of having this work done out of a academic lab, it's hard to disqualify. And so political parties, as Andrea just said, they now know we're going to do it. And that's a moment they feel vulnerable to what we say publicly. And so they want to score better. And as a result, that then inclines them to think about how can they shape their platforms and the budget commitments that go with those platforms accordingly. And that is this great part of the Gen Squeeze strategy and mission, to like wed the power of public opinion to these unique windows of opportunity in a political cycle to exercise influence on the promises being made to us. It's one of the key developments that we've made at Gen Squeeze over the decade. We didn't do that early on. This is a latter part of Gen Squeeze's strategy. And, you know, Andrea's, I think, really nailed identifying why it's an important part of what we do and shapes how we then operate in the world of politics. I mean, some might know that we have this pledge campaign going on where we're asking our political leaders to pledge to be Gen Fairness champions. And, you know, that's another way where we're, you know, we frame issues, people we hope want to be seen as Gen Fairness champions, and that then creates other ways for us to go and have these conversations, and then it becomes clear, like, look, we're going to be looking at your platforms, evaluating them, like, okay, well, how do we score well on those things? And it's just this ongoing dialogue over years that ultimately contributes to some of the systems change we're trying to achieve and why we say on our website we win sometimes. Not as much as I'd like, not as much as we need to, but sometimes.
So on our Advise Governments page, we say, quote, "We have a proven track record as a small but mighty powerhouse in the world of politics and will continue to pursue every opportunity to share our expertise with governments. We'll share our asks with you along the way and sometimes ask you to share them too." And I'm kind of wondering, what about the question of, you know, asking the people in our network, like, is there something that they can help us with? Is there some, whether it's in the form of feedback or other things, they can provide us to help us in the work that we're doing in this particular kind of work?
Yeah, that's a great question, Amir. In fact, we were chatting a little bit about that in advance, whether to go down. You know, we had this brief conversation earlier about, like, you know, how much do we engage people in things like petitions or like letter writing, or maybe that's not the kind of organization we are. But we weren't actually sure if we kind of settled on a narrative we wanted to offer around that, or you know, the amount of emphasis we wanted to put on that. So you actually might want to weigh in on that too, Umair, from that standpoint. But anyway, I just wanted to flag that going in.
Yeah, just for the listeners, like, these aren't like pre-planned discussions. Like, I don't even send Paul and Andrea the questions I'm going to ask, like, on purpose.
We really wish you would.
Yeah, sorry.
It would be easier. So on the cuff, we do think it matters when we ask people to write or tweet or what have you.
Yeah, I think we do. Absolutely. Of course, we think it matters. You know, Paul's already talked about how our network is really important to us. It's important both because it what power it can illustrate or influence that it can illustrate. And it's also important because it does, you know, grow the legitimacy and profile of issues around generational fairness in Canada. So absolutely, we want to hear from people. We want the benefit of your input and expertise, and we want your ideas. So I think we're always open to hearing from folks if they think, if they have suggestions or ideas on what we could do better, what more they would like to see in terms of types of information or options for engagement. I think we're always open to that.
Well, we're intentional about that too. I mean, we ask people at the end of our pod episodes, the emails that go out to solicit feedback. We do annual surveys on that front. And people take us up on that opportunity. They send, I get emails, you get emails, the info at gensqueeze.ca gets emails. I think that the place where we have this ongoing question is we've never been able to light as much a fire under as many in our network as I would have imagined some years ago in terms of, okay, we've made it easy right now to send a letter to your MP or your MPP MLA, your elected representative. Do that with us. We've never been super strong at that. Or I think we have an activity right now, you know, tweet out to your elected official. We'll facilitate. We want $10 a day to be the max, not the average fee. I'm like, I'm not sure we're very good at getting people to do that. That worries me, and Andrea and I, you know, we chat about that a lot. But Umair, like, I'm going to turn it back to you, because I think since you've been joining the team, you've been pushing us to think about, does that need to be the way in which we operate? Is that what we most need from our alliance? Is that actually what our alliance thinks is meaningful for engagement for them? And so what do you think, Umair?
Yeah, so I think the basic framework is we have a kind of inside game, right? We meet with government officials, we meet with public servants whenever we're invited, or sometimes we apply to be a part of the discussion. So we do that on the one hand, and then we have an outside game where we have a network that we can mobilize to help to push governments and policy change from the outside. And so these two things sort of work in tandem. And I think that that's a perfectly good framework to have.
And I sensed an and.
Yes. And in fact, you know, my background is in the latter, right? It's in mobilizing people and doing organizing work. And so that's where I'm most comfortable. But the more, I guess, we are thinking about it and trying to do that work and thinking about the history of that work within the organization and finding that maybe that's not where our strengths are. Yeah, the more I'm thinking, okay, so then is there a way for us to frame things a bit differently, do things a bit differently? And as part of our advising government's work, we do have this idea that we ask people to lend their voice, right? That we want to speak on their behalf. And so I think maybe that's something that we need to underscore. And as part of that, you know, to ask people very pointedly, like at this point, you've heard several examples of the ways in which we have meetings and, you know, attend committees and that sort of thing. What do you want us to say in those? Right? So that would be one way I think we could ask people in our network to contribute to this work.
Well, let's do that more.
Okay.
I mean, let's formalize it more, not just as, I guess, asks at the end of our pod episodes and at the bottom of our emails. You know, that's working in some ways. And we have, is it like the sort of the annual kind of survey that we do? But what would it look like? What would it look like for our listeners, though, to respond? Are they just, you know, are they sending us an email at info@gensqueeze in response to this podcast episode? Are they reaching out to us directly? Like, maybe we need to be talking about, well, what does that look like more? It seems so simple. And yet, it's not as simple to execute.
Well, yeah, I'm wondering if it's as simple as I'm thinking, and it may not be. But one of the ways I'm thinking it could be done is that if we have a meeting that's coming up that we can sort of talk about openly and share the details of openly, and I imagine this committee meeting in the Senate would have been one example, then we could, as part of our monthly emails that we sent out to the list, or as part of our social media sort of work, we could mention that this is one of the things that's coming up for us, you know, and this is the topic of this meeting, and this is what we're going to be saying, like, what do you want us to raise? Creating those kind of opportunities. But that means that we have to be more on the ball about, like, okay, so this is going to happen in a month. And I don't know if we always know that things are going to happen in a month.
Yeah. We rarely have that kind of time horizon, whether it's like the Senate invitation came up with, like, I think it was not even 72 hours notice. And oftentimes when we actually are lucky to either get invites or nail down meetings we've asked for, they're getting done relatively short order. But one thing we know absolutely with tons and tons of advance notice, and to some degree, Andrea already featured this earlier in the conversation, the budget process is a year-long process. It gets introduced sometime in the spring of a calendar year. But the process to both analyze the last one and influence the next one is a year-long thing. Like, we could be routinizing quarterly requests for people to weigh in on, what do you think we should tell the federal government? What should we tell the provincial government where you live? That's something we could definitely routinize. And, you know, we think that the emails we send out, and now we even have on our website, like, will you give permission? Like, we'll touch base with you once a month kind of thing. So it's like scarce, precious email attention time. But if maybe we should be using, you know, four of those a year to specifically solicit the feedback. We haven't been using them quite that way. And we can give prompts like on housing or prompts on family affordability, prompts on climate change or prompts on deficits or prompts on, you know, investing where health begins. Those are we can give those prompts. And I guess let's see what that'll do for us. And we can have a podcast episode in a year from now, see whether or not that lit the fire under a whole bunch of our alliance.
I wonder if there could be another dimension to that as well, because I think it would be great if folks have an opportunity to weigh in about what's important to them and help us to see the issues that are top of mind in the policy landscape. But, you know, I'm also aware that's not always a straightforward ask. Like, there's a lot going on. We're talking to our whole, a big part of our raison d'etre is that we're talking to a group of people in large part who are squeezed for time. They're squeezed for money. They're squeezed between their childcare pressures and other pressures. So I think that there's another element that we could consider that, you know, we have spent a lot of time looking at the policy landscape. Happily, we get to be paid to do that, which is a real privilege. And so, you know, we've distilled all those things down into what we think are some of the core asks that we think it's timely and important to put forward right now. But I think what, you know, would be great to hear as well from our network of supporters on is, you know, how do those asks resonate in your life? Like, how do you experience some of these kinds of challenges that we're pointing to? You know, especially when we're talking about, you know, challenging things. One of the messages that we're, you know, really working on trying to figure out how to put out there right now is around some of the climate change and affordability pressures that we're seeing. So, you know, we're seeing a number of political officials and governments, you know, question whether we should be continuing with carbon taxation or continuing with taxing things like fuel when people are struggling with the cost of living right now and how quickly they're rising. I think for an organization like Generation Squeeze, you know, we're saying, wow, like, no, we can't solve the affordability pressures we're facing by scaling back our action on climate change, because that's a huge intergenerational injustice. We cannot afford to delay further than we already have what we need to do to mitigate the enormous costs and risks that are going to be disproportionately borne by younger and future generations. So we can say that. I think we can provide the evidence to back up that claim. But it sure would be interesting, I think, to hear from folks on the ground, like when they're figuring out in their own lives how to balance the rising costs of living, how to balance their commitments to being, you know, good climate change activists. You know, what does that mean for them? How do they struggle with that? How do they think about that? How do they think about the trade-offs? How do they talk to their kids about it? Because I think sometimes those kinds of stories can really be a powerful way of illustrating, you know, the broader point driven by the evidence and the data.
It's really interesting, Andrea. I think that does point to where we can and have really good reason to keep trying to solicit more from our alliance for the work we're doing advising government. I can imagine, though, like, let's say we have our four recommendations for provincial and federal governments. They're tailored to each jurisdiction. The last one has sort of 4 points. But what if people said, you know, I don't really care if governments start monitoring how how we spend money by age, or I don't really care if governments start telling us about how much they invest on social issues relative to medical issues, or I don't really care if they fix how we measure housing inflation. That's not really interests me. I want to make housing less expensive tomorrow, and I want to make, you know, I want to be addressing biodiversity tomorrow. And these things, they look too technical. To be honest, though, Gen Squeeze would not say, oh, okay, we're going to stop doing that. That's not the kind of organization we are. And I think it's actually important to be like clear and upfront with that. We are a marriage of the community and the university. And the university has some really important technical things to say. And it may not be the sexiest part of our work, but it is critical to the change making that we're doing. It's critical to actually making the systems that government shapes with its policy decisions work more effectively for all generations. And I think that is one of the reasons why we are this small but mighty powerhouse in the world of politics, is that we are this interesting merger of bottom up and academic, I was going to say sideways, if not top down, we're like academic sideways, bottom up, trying to then go and be influential in the world of politics. And the two should go hand in hand. And there are ways to marry the power of experiential expertise with the power of academic expertise. And our budget asks and our work in the world of politics does those two things together. Can we do them better? Can we marry them better? I think we've been talking about how to harness more of the voices of our constituency. But we're not setting up an organization where, like, you know, we're going to crowdsource all of our recommendations, because some of the more technical stuff is not sexy. But I absolutely am convinced that the academic evidence tells us that we need to mobilize around some of this not so sexy stuff, because it lays the foundation for solving the problems that are top of mind. And sexy is no longer the right word, but like the thing that's so urgent in our day-to-day lives in terms of affordability, or the existential crisis of climate change, or the absolute unfairness of inheriting unpaid bills from those who come before us. Those are things that people will feel, but you can't solve them only by addressing the symptom. You got to get at the systems level. And some of the technical stuff we're often doing is aiming to do that systems disruption more so than I think most people are focused on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think people in our network, you know, they follow us partly to, because they're interested in some of the technical details. That's the feedback we get. In fact, that people are happy to learn about some of those things, including, you know, about budgets.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Okay. What do we think? Is that a good place to wrap?
I think we're rapidly running out of time. So I think it's a great place to wrap. I mean, if I reflect, Andrea, it's been a wide-ranging conversation, and it's really unpacking a big chunk of our theory of change about how we need to make meaning of the evidence in light of people's values in order to shape opinions and frame beliefs, and then we got to bring it to decision makers. And today's been a big conversation about how we bring it to decision makers, both with an outside game and an inside game, and the two things work in tandem in getting invitations for us or soliciting on our behalf that we get invited in. And if there ever are any other academics out there who are paying attention to our Hard Truths podcast, then I'll go back to the hard truth and just remind us in the academy, evidence rarely is enough to influence public policy. And I think there's an opportunity for Gen Squeeze to actually be more useful for other academics in the housing field, the climate field, the family affordability field, thinking about what makes us healthy and not just treat our illness, budgets more generally. I think we can use the impressive machinery we've created to help mobilize not just evidence coming out of the Gen Squeeze lab, but we're constantly synthesizing evidence from everywhere. And the more academics we can involve in doing that, I think that in some regards, we can be useful to a broader range of people in the academy to make their evidence as impactful as it can be in the world of politics.